It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. After 4 years on the Pittsburgh School Board, Valerie McDonald Roberts served 8 years on City Council. Then, after working about a dozen years in county government, she was one of the first appointments to Mayor Bill Peduto's new administration. Now, Chief Urban Affairs Officer Valerie McDonald Roberts is with us in studio. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so why did you want to return to city government? And what about the position of Chief Urban Affairs Officer appeals to you?
Well, I was recruited. I was happy in the county. Mm-hmm. I was proud of my position, proud to serve. But Mayor William Peduto, when he won in 2013, was developing his senior staff. And I was asked by Kevin Acklin, actually, met with him, and he asked for me to serve as Chief Urban Affairs Officer. I gave it some thought because I wasn't living in the city at that time. And I decided that, you know, I know Bill Peduto from when he served as an aide to Councilman Dan Cohen.
Yeah.
And I had great respect for him then. It was a very unique person in terms of policy, in terms of his thought process. I really liked what I saw, and I was so glad that he ran and he won. So I decided to accept the position.
So did the mayor or his then chief of staff, Kevin Acklin, as you said, did they have the position already defined, or did you help define the position?
Come on, you know Bill Peduto. We know our mayor. He's got things already set up. And he had studied, as he always does. He does a lot of benchmarking, a lot of research, and what are best practices. And he adopted this structure of government where he would have eight chiefs. And that would be public safety, that would be law, that would be administration, operations, urban affairs. So there were eight of us originally. And it was a very flat type of reporting measure. It evolved over the years, and it ended up more vertical, not totally vertical, but much more vertically structured than what it was. So, yeah, he had a plan in place on how he wanted to allocate responsibilities.
I mentioned your time on city council. Now that you're back, and well, you have been since early 2014, right. But now that you're back in city government, what does this position allow you to do that maybe you couldn't do as a longtime member of Pittsburgh City Council?
Well, you know, you learn. One thing is the evolution of me in my career, and particularly in politics and government and elected office, was starting at school board, you learn what it is to set policy at the school district level. You learn what the delineation between executive branch and legislative branch, what school board members do, what the superintendent and administration does. I carried that with me to city council. But in a legislative branch, you have ideas you can enact, you can ask for the administration to enforce, but you don't have that executive ability to make sure it's done. What you do is you run across a hall and yell. So when I got to the county as an independent elected official, it was not legislative. It happened to be a row office that was an elected position that was actually executive in its nature. So I had an opportunity for 12 years to do the executive side of managing, of implementing policy and making it happen. And I brought that to the city. So that's what I enjoy, is implementation. I can tell you right now, I sometimes fuss up and down the hallway about policy, ideas, reports, benchmarking, yada, yada. I like to implement, I like to do, I like accountability and follow-up.
All right. You know, there are people out there, they're saying, all right, he hasn't mentioned this. I do want to mention it. Do you take pride in being the first African-American woman elected to city council?
That was a proud thing at that time. I don't even think about it, Kevin.
Yeah,
honestly, it's been so long ago.
But people who don't know you.
This is not baloney. I'm a very humble person. That is my Christian background. I don't take a lot of pride. I tend to mitigate all of that. You know, you'll rarely see me even on social media. I don't do selfies of myself. I just don't. I like to celebrate others. I like to get things done. My pride is getting things done. My proudest moment is not being the first African-American woman elected to city council. I love people who do take pride in that, and I want them to celebrate. You got to give people things to celebrate, to be proud of. But my proudest moment was getting things done. That police reform was one of my proudest moments, to put anti-predatory lending as an issue on the on the radar,
right,
for people not to get taken advantage of, and to set up a mechanism with PCRG, Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group, to make sure that we help people get out of financially devastating situations. Those were my proud moments of what did you do? Let your deeds speak for you.
All right, let's talk about some of the deeds that you are doing now. I want to focus for a couple minutes on housing. That is one of your purviews. You've chaired the Housing Authority Board. I mean, for years we've been hearing the city needs thousands and thousands of units of affordable housing. Is the city making any progress, really? And how so?
Listen, if it wasn't for the mayor's position and the tone that is set amongst all the staff, is that affordable housing, that we don't displace people. The people that weathered the storm of Pittsburgh in its evolution, going from 600,000+ people down to 300,000 people, to see a school system lose the population of its students. People have weathered the storm. They shall not be displaced. And that is the mayor's mandate, basically. We have to compete with market influences. We have to grow the city. You can't survive with just low-income housing. You have to survive with a mix of incomes. That is how the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, the URA, this is the direction that we are going in, is a mix of people. No. Do we have enough housing? No. I mean, that's kind of like a black and white kind of fact there, if you read it. Even in a county, there tends to be less of a pool of good quality affordable housing as well. What are we going to do? The mayor has to stay the course as far as policy and making sure that we keep that in the front of us, that we don't do projects unless we have that in consideration. The Housing Opportunity Fund is one mechanism that he has generated that is going to help make sure that we maintain affordable housing, and not just build affordable housing, but improve the affordable housing stock that we have here in the city.
Do we have the resources to help move people from rental units, sort of denser kind of situations, to homes? And do we have the resources to help them do that?
Absolutely. That is also one of the priorities of the Peduto administration, is to make sure that there is home ownership. Again, through mechanisms such as the Housing Opportunity Fund, through resources that are brought in by banks to improve home ownership. The Housing Authority has a program for home ownership. The URA has mechanisms to help people to get through home ownership as well as improvement of their properties. All of these forces are being pulled together, and they have to work synergistically together to make sure that we move people from a low-income rental to home ownership. But trust me, Kevin, it's not that easy.
No.
People are very comfortable in a rental arrangement. It's less stressful. It makes sense for their lives, for many people. Case in point, the Housing Authority, through, oh my goodness, tens of thousands of residents that there are, there were only maybe 10 to 20 people who actually completed the home ownership program and were on their way to home ownership. You can't force people to own homes. You encourage them, but you meet people where they're at. Not everyone is in a position to be a homeowner. Maybe they don't want to be a homeowner, but it's incumbent upon any municipality, any government, to make sure that housing is provided that meets the needs of the people, period.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to get very quickly to one of your areas of supervision is human relations. Briefly, what's the biggest challenge here to improving human relations in the city?
Well, we had a very terrible tragedy that really hit us over the head and brought it to the fore as far as is hate. I think that the tone, if that's what you're referring to, the hate that is, we have to just stay on top of this. And we have to make sure that the tone is set. Hate is not welcome here. Bias is not welcome here. The one thing that the mayor has done in terms of initiating Welcoming Pittsburgh, a large initiative, it's actually a national initiative, but we have a local part of that initiative, is for immigrant engagement. It's basically to say, you are welcome here. We are one. That is the tone that is set at the top. I would say between the county executive, because again, the city is not an island.
Right.
We are part of this region. So our elected officials have that tone. And it definitely trickles down into making staff members like me accountable to making sure that that happens.
In our last minute or so, human relations, how does that apply to a gender equity study that has been proposed within city government to make sure that we're equitable within our own city workforce, that there, you know, that there isn't pay bias, that there isn't promotion bias? 1 minute to go.
And the recent stat was 49 cents on a dollar nationally due to some other factors. The Gender Equity Commission came about because of an individual who is no longer a city council member, and that is Natalia Rudiak.
Right.
I give her full credit for that. But she worked with the administration, with Mayor Peduto, to make sure that this issue was, again, brought to the fore, brought in front of us, not behind us. There is going to be a Gender Equity Commission, a disparity study within the city government. We have dynamite commissioners on the commission. And again, it is going to happen where we also look at not just race, ethnicity. We're looking at gender, which is a big, big disparity that's throughout the region.
And very briefly, you got to look in-house first before you
That's
put it
exactly
out.
It. We're looking at clean up your own house before you go, you know, judging others, others' homes. So we're going to clean up our house.
Valerie McDonald Roberts is the Chief Urban Affairs Officer for the City of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
People have been mad at the Grammys for as long as the Grammys have existed. On this day in 1959, Bobby Darin took home a couple of gilded gramophones. He won Record of the Year for Mac the Knife and was given the Best New Artist Award. It was the first time the Grammys were televised. The issue? It was the only time the ceremony took place at the end of the year, thus snubbing any records released in December of 1959. The problem was corrected the following year, and awards for music released in 1960 were given out in early 1961. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The owners of the largest coal ash pond east of the Mississippi are asking the Department of Environmental Protection for a new pollution discharge permit. A hearing was held in Beaver County last night. Reed Frazier is reporter for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. He covered that meeting, joins us now. Good morning, Reed.
Good morning, Kevin.
So briefly, what's coal ash and where is Little Blue Run?
Well, coal ash is kind of like what it sounds like. It's what's left over when you burn coal, but it also includes the material that is used to clean the exhaust from coal when it goes through a coal-fired power plant. But it's basically this sort of dusty material, and what happens is it goes into, they mix it with water and pour it into these ponds called impoundments to store it.
All right, and where's Little Blue Run?
Okay, Little Blue Run is right on the Pennsylvania-West Virginia border, hard by the Ohio River on the south bank.
Okay, but in Pennsylvania, because that's why DEP is involved.
Yeah, it's taking waste from the Bruce Mansfield Power Plant in Beaver County, which is the largest in Pennsylvania.
Okay, so it's been closed as a dump site, right, for a couple of years?
Yeah.
Why so?
DEP, well, it goes back a little ways, but in the 70s when it was built, it was unlined, which meant there was nothing to prevent the toxic pollutants from the coal ash from leaching into the ground and getting into groundwater and surrounding streams. So in 2012, the DEP ordered the First Energy, which by then owned the coal ash dump, to close it and sort of cease operations there.
Okay, so the new permit is needed. Why? I mean, they can't now line it. It's too late to do that?
It's kind of too late for that.
Okay, but what's the new permit for?
So what's happened since 2012 is that the company's found new seeps, basically. So imagine this impoundment is like a big pool of slushy coal ash, and it's sitting on top of an earthen dam about 400 feet. High. And on all sides of that dam, there's sort of water coming out of it in these tiny little seeps. And that water is can be polluted. So what the DEP has done is said, and anytime you release, you know, some sort of pollution of that type, you have to get a permit because of federal laws. So this new permit will encompass all the new sources that are coming from that site.
And will allow it to go into the Ohio River, discharge some of that? And is that because it's a bigger body of water, it could dilute it better?
Yeah, so basically what's happening now is that those seeps are going into these smaller streams, which are obviously way small, have much less water than the Ohio River. Some of that water is going to get pumped back into Little Blue Run, those outfalls. Some of it's going to get diverted into the Ohio River, which has a much bigger flow, obviously.
All right, we have about a minute left, just a minute. So what's the danger here in terms of pollutants, and what's the next step?
Well, coal ash contains a lot of naturally occurring but nonetheless toxic materials like arsenic, mercury, selenium. And so there's a danger to aquatic life and fish, but also, you know, it's gotten into groundwater, and some people in the surrounding area have had their groundwater affected by these materials. So the next step is for the DEP to kind of go through this permit and see if there's any changes they need to make it more safe. And they'll issue the permit sometime in 2019. And meanwhile, the company is going forward with plans to cap it and close it. And that final date should be around 2028.
All right. Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. Reed, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Former Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane has been ordered to report to jail this morning to begin serving her sentence for perjury, obstruction, and other charges. Mark Scalfaro is a reporter for the Associated Press. Mark, thanks so much for taking the time.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I am well, sir, and hope you are the same. Mark, there have been several developments this week alone in the case of Kathleen Kane, starting with the state Supreme Court declining to hear her appeal of her conviction. What, if anything, did the state Supreme Court say when deciding not to hear the appeal?
Not much. It was a very short one-sentence order. That's not unusual when they don't take a case. They just turn it down. If they accept the case, they'll maybe say what they want to focus on. But previously, she had also lost a much more detailed decision from the state Superior Court that had turned down a variety of different issues she had raised in challenging her 2016 conviction.
And this had all started, the legal proceedings as far as trials had started in county court, correct?
That's right, in a courthouse in suburban Philadelphia, Montgomery County. Yeah, she was convicted in 2016 of perjury, obstruction, and a number of other charges for essentially for lying, for leaking grand jury information and then lying about it. She's been out on bail ever since pending appeal, which is why after the state Supreme Court did not accept her appeal on Monday, prosecutors sought to revoke her bail, which a judge granted on Tuesday.
When she was ordered to report, she asked for a little more time. Why so?
She asked for that on Wednesday. She, the motion before the county judge asking for a conference and a delay in her report time made reference to the fact that she's a single mother, two teenage boys, two in high school, and that and she needed the extra time would help her nail down the arrangements with her ex and with her family for those boys.
And the judge quickly responded, how?
Well, it was about an hour after her request was filed, and the judge issued a two-sentence order saying it's denied without a hearing and repeating that she has to surrender.
So any idea from the judge saying, look, you've been out on bail for about 2 years. You've had time to arrange for the custody of your teenage children just in case things went against you? Or was that not even mentioned?
No, it was not. Now, the same judge, a day earlier on Tuesday, when she granted the prosecution's request to revoke bail, did go into a little more detail, not much, but she said essentially there's no legal basis for her to remain free at this point. I mean, if she was free on bail pending appeals and the state Supreme Court turned her down, that's the highest court in the state, so that was the end of the road.
Okay, Mark, let's go back a bit. As you mentioned, she was convicted on the perjury and obstruction charges, but what were those charges connected to? Leaked information?
When Kathleen Kane was running as a Democrat for attorney general in 2012, and she was the first woman and first Democrat in the state to be elected attorney general, by the way, since the state established that as an elected position in 1980. But when she was running for office, she was critical of how the office under her predecessor had handled the Jerry Sandusky child abuse investigation. And in fact, she ended up, people may recall, she ended up commissioning a report about that. But that engendered, I think, some unhappy feelings among people who had worked on that case. But at any rate, not long after she took office, there was a story in the Philadelphia Daily News about a completely unrelated investigation involving an NAACP chairman in Philadelphia that had stalled under Kane. That it stalled, and she was involved in leaking that to the paper. And some of the prosecutors who had worked under her predecessor contacted a judge in Montgomery County, suburban Philadelphia, to alert him about this purported leak of grand jury material, and he appointed a special prosecutor. That decision was heavily litigated and ultimately upheld by the state Supreme Court. And it was that investigation that resulted finally in her conviction in August of 2016 and then her subsequent sentencing.
You alluded to one of the prosecutors, former state prosecutors, Frank Fina. She alleged that he didn't go after strong enough corruption allegations, I guess, against the one-time head of the Philadelphia NAACP.
I think that at this point, probably everyone involved would have a different perspective on motivations and what occurred, but the sequence of events is that it was that story in the Philadelphia Daily News that caused Frank Fina and another prosecutor in the office to contact the judge, and that got the wheels in motion that led to the appointment of a special prosecutor who investigated her.
There was something else that actually came out of this. Kane dug up a bunch of emails that were quite embarrassing for legal officials, for lawyers, and for a couple of state Supreme Court justices. The Porngate.
Yeah, what's the pornographic email scandal? That's right, and that actually does again play into her criminal story in a couple of ways. For one, she sought to introduce evidence regarding that as showing, you know, state of mind or reflecting why she, you know, she wanted to bring that into her own trial. The judge did not allow that. That was one of that decision preventing her from introducing evidence about the pornographic email scandal, which, by the way, did implicate Mr. Fina as well as Mark Costanzo, the other attorney who had reported the leak to the county judge. But she's not allowed to introduce that evidence, and that was part of her appeal, and Superior Court turned that down, saying that it was not relevant. And I think what she had hoped was that the state Supreme Court would then take up that issue, or she also wanted to bring up the issue about the, you know, how the Sandusky case was handled and her critique of that. She's not allowed to discuss that either. That also was not was deemed by Superior Court not to be a reason to overturn her conviction, and she had hoped that that would be something that the High Court would take up. So she was not in office very long, but it was a very eventful few years.
So you mentioned first woman elected Pennsylvania Attorney General, first Democrat to be elected Attorney General. And of course, Pennsylvania, she's not the first former Attorney General to go to jail. Ernie Prieto served a year in federal prison for mail fraud, by the way. But you mentioned an eventful time while she was a rising star, wasn't she, for a while?
Yeah, when she was elected, she was swept in office. It was not a close race. She was talked about. She's still kind of a newcomer to the state's political scene, but she was talked about as somebody who might have had a very promising future in Pennsylvania politics. She's a lawyer, of course, and she had been a prosecutor in Scranton, but she had not been. I don't believe she'd ever held any elected office before that.
So Kathleen Kane will serve her sentence where and for how long?
The Montgomery County Correctional Facility, again, in the Philadelphia suburbs. And her sentence is 10 to 23 months. 10 months is the minimum, as I'm sure you and your listeners know. And then in Pennsylvania, we have a minimum and maximum. Her maximum sentence is 23 months. So it is likely she would serve close to 10 months, but you never know.
Has there been a request that you know of? Are any special accommodations being made? Because let's face it, at one time she was the state's top law enforcement officer. So any special accommodations for maybe her safety while she's in jail?
It's a good question. And I think I read something today indicating that they may be looking at that. It wouldn't surprise me.
So my final question for you, Mark, is how do you sum up this whole case of Kathleen Kane? A bit of a rising star and then, wow, winds up in prison.
You know, I think it does illustrate the challenge for people who run for elected office, which is running and winning is one thing, but then also holding office and successfully governing can present its own challenges and really can be quite risky.
Mark Scalfaro is a reporter for the Associated Press. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a lovely day.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, as part of a major restructuring, General Motors announced plans to indefinitely idle 5 plants in North America, 2 in Michigan, 1 in Maryland, 1 in Canada, and its assembly facility in Lordstown, Ohio, just 75 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Jordan Grzeleski is a reporter for The Vindicator, the Youngstown newspaper. Jordan, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please give us a sense of how important the Lordstown plant has been to the community, to the Mahoning Valley, over the last, say, 5 decades, I guess.
The GM Lordstown plant has been critically important to the valley. It started operation here in 1966, and just a few short years later is when, you know, the steel industry collapsed, and this area went through an economically devastating time. So I think kind of the sense is that GM Lordstown has kind of been a lifeline for this community for the past 52 years. So the news on Monday was devastating to this area.
And it has been the major employer in the region?
Yes. Just recently in our story today, we reported that as of 2017, it was still the largest employer in Trumbull County. At its peak, I believe it employed up to 10,000 people. And as of the end of 2016, there were still close to 5,000 people. And now with the laying off of 2 of those shifts in the last 2 years, we're down to 1,500 who will, you know, now be laid off next year.
I read comments from people that you spoke with for your reporting, including devastating, a shot in the gut. Are you getting a sense yet of just how big of an economic blow this will be, or is it still settling in?
I think the wider economic impact is still kind of to be determined. I think that that's a story we're going to try to follow in the next few weeks and, you know, talk to people who are studying this. But we do know just in our initial reporting about some of the impacts it'll have on Trumbull County, We just reported this week that the water department for the city of Warren is set to lose $500,000 per year just from selling water to the plant. We know that the village of Lordstown, where the plant is located, estimates that it'll lose about $1 million from income tax revenue just from this last shift being shut down. And we know that about 1,500 people will be laid off just from the plant and a few of the local companies that contract with it. But what that doesn't include is all of the other companies in the supply chain that will feel the effects of this.
You report that this announcement really is the latest in a series of economic job hits that the Valley has experienced this year. So it's been seemingly one thing after another?
I would say to a certain extent, yeah, that's true. Earlier this year, we also lost a hospital, which employed about 500 people. We had a couple of Sears stores close. We had several Toys R Us stores close. We had a Kmart distribution center close, which is not to say that there aren't good things happening here. You know, we have the downtown Youngstown is, you know, revitalizing, and you hear a lot of talk about the renaissance of downtown Youngstown. You know, we do have some major things happening in Lordstown as well with the opening this year of a $1 billion energy center. There are plans to break ground next year on a huge TJX home goods distribution center. But I think this year has been difficult to have, you know, those job losses and then this news. This just plays into it even more.
The plant is idled indefinitely, not closed. So as GM indicated, what will happen to the facility? Are there any hopes to retrofit it to make another model?
Yes, I'm hearing that there is still hope. GM has not said that it's permanently closed. What's going to happen is as of March 1st, 2019, production of the cruise will end and the plant will be idling. I'm told that next summer and fall will be really a critical period in determining what ultimately happens with the plant, as the UAW and GM will be in contract negotiations, which is typically when decisions about new product allocations are made. So in speaking with experts and analysts this week, they say that Lordstown will likely be in kind of a competition with the other plants that are idling as to, you know, who is going to receive a new product. One thing that I've been hearing from the local economic development community is that there's some hope that GM might consider Lordstown for some of its alternative fuel or electric vehicle projects, which is something that GM has really invested heavily in recently. So while this was a very grim week and is not good news for the Valley, I think that people are still trying to hold out hope that the plant might get another product.
Jordan Grzeleski is a reporter for The Vindicator, the Youngstown newspaper. Jordan, thanks so much for your coverage.
Thank you.
Joining us now on The Confluence is Post-Gazette business reporter Daniel Moore. Daniel, reporter Jordan Grzeleski from The Vindicator says the job losses are devastating to the community, a shot in the gut. You were in your Lordstown this week. What did you find there?
Yeah, kind of building off what Jordan was saying, it would have a really huge impact on this region as a whole. The plant itself is so physically large, but there's also a lot of suppliers that are built up around the plant. And, you know, anybody who's driven from here in Pittsburgh up to Cleveland has seen the GM facility. It kind of hugs the Ohio Turnpike on the right side of the road if you're headed north. But in addition to the plant itself, there's all these factories and distributors that supply the plant. And these are huge facilities that employ a lot of people. It's almost like a self-sufficient city of industrial plants that all rely on this GM plant and rely on the fact that it assembles vehicles. Mm-hmm. So the mayor of Lordstown estimated that about seven jobs depend on one job at the GM plant. So if you kind of extrapolate that out, looking down to Pittsburgh, obviously we have a lot of steel companies here that supply the auto industry. We have a lot of companies that manufacture windows, seats, components, So there's definitely a deep supply chain that extends to Western PA, and I think everyone's still trying to figure out how this is all going to shake out.
Mm-hmm. So there have been cutbacks at this plant over the last several years, but were union workers taken off guard by this week's announcement by GM?
You know, it wasn't a total surprise. Some of the union workers were surprised by the timing of it. You know, I think Jordan mentioned that there had been some shift cuts over the last couple of years. It's gone from three shifts down to one shift at the plant. But the timing was kind of surprising. They thought their jobs were safe for at least a couple of more years. But other companies have been pulling back in the small car market. I mean, this is really a business decision based on market demand. American buyers aren't buying as much smaller vehicle or as many smaller vehicles. Sales of the Chevy Cruze have plummeted by about a third since 2014. So this is a decision that GM made based on market demand. And it's something that union workers were kind of expecting, but they weren't expecting to happen on Monday, that they would just eliminate production entirely.
Just a couple minutes left. Did you find much, if any, hope that the Lordstown plant could be repurposed by GM, retrofitted to produce a different vehicle?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And to kind of put it in perspective, the plant has produced about a dozen different types of vehicles since 1966 when it opened. So it has changed the type of vehicle that it's assembled, and it's been making the Chevy Cruze since about 2011. So if you read the tea leaves from GM's announcement, they did say the plant is in unallocated status, which means, you know, they could fill it with another product. They're not just going to permanently close it March 1st. So there is some optimism. The union is interpreting that as a signal that they will be able to bargain, as Jordan said, to assemble another type of vehicle at the plant. However, in talking with the Chamber of Commerce up there, it sounds like that would be a pretty big investment. The plant is very old. GM probably wants something that's a little bit smaller and more nimble. So, you know, while it's inconceivable that they would pull out to a lot of people from that region, it's also a large investment that they would have to make to convert that to produce something else. So it's definitely an uncertain period up there right now.
In our last minute, you alluded to a bit about a potential ripple effect. So how might this indefinitely idling of the Lordstown, Ohio plant, 75 miles from Pittsburgh, might affect us in western Pennsylvania? We have about a minute.
Well, you know, I think, like I said, the steel companies, the auto market is a huge customer of the steel industry. Usually the steel industry operates on contracts with certain plants and companies. So, you know, it's likely the steel industry as a whole has been able to absorb, you know, this one plant idling for at least a year. But certainly there's companies and smaller manufacturers, like I said, that were kind of built around this plant that maybe they have other accounts at other plants. But, you know, if you're based in Lordstown or that kind of northwest Pennsylvania area and Sharon, there's a lot of companies up there that make components for cars that might have been caught off guard by this announcement and now have to find another auto assembler to send their materials to, which, you know, would be very much, much farther than Lordstown. So, you know, that could certainly have a ripple effect reaching all the way down to Pittsburgh and beyond.
Daniel Moore is a business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we visit with Angela Garcia, Executive Director of Global Links, which provides medical and developmental relief in resource-poor communities, and it redirects medical equipment to support public health in the Western Hemisphere. Also, Christmas traditions in Pittsburgh, including the Carnegie Trees exhibit. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.